We are trying to create a new expectation that we will convene our Senate committee within 5 minutes of our official start time. So I've actually extended that a little bit on one way. On the other hand, you could say we are 25 minutes ahead of our usual start time. So we'll see how this goes. Representative Seifert has asked me to chair today. He has a bill up in committee, and he will be leaving at a certain point in time. And you see the agenda before you. We have we've just been doing a basic overviews in the Senate committee as well, and we just thought it would be an opportunity for us to do these together and for us to start to understand the different points of view that each body has or different questions that each body has about these our budget areas. And I don't know, Representative Seifert, if you wish to make any comment about our... Not that we're planning to do a bill together, but eventually we will be in conference committee together, and let's start by understanding the issues together and establishing good communication. So, Representative Seifert.
Good morning. I think the main purpose of having joint hearings, at least in my thought process, was that we have jurisdiction over the same budget areas, and it didn't make a lot of sense when we have duplicative things going on and having the same people running over to the Capitol building and running over to the state office building, giving same presentation, answering similar questions. It helps in flow of information. It helps with staff time. I think it helps with when we get to conference, we're not asking questions. We're all at the same table, and we can try to get on the same page early. So this is one of the first times that I know of that since I've been here since 1996 that we've actually had a joint hearing set up in a real structured way that handles the same thing. That's not a formally deemed commission. We're not a commission. We're a joint committee. So this is something hopefully the other budget divisions will try to get past the turf wars and the old way of doing things and try to get on the same page to get things done in a timely, constructive manner. So thank you, Senator Cascaden, for taking the opportunity to do this. Appreciate it.
Well, I think if we are going to be advocating for efficiency in government, we need to look to be efficient ourselves if we can. So, let's begin with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jean Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. With me, I have Jeff Sigurdson, who is the Assistant Director. We are staffed to a six-member board. All six members are appointed by the governor to staggered four-year terms. Members must be confirmed by a three-fifths majority of both the House and Senate acting separately. At least two of the members must be former legislators. Hilda Betterman and Bob Milbert currently fill those positions. No more than three members may be of the same political party. We currently have three Republicans, Terry Ashmore, who is the chair, Ms. Betterman and Felicia Boyd, two DFLers, Mr. Milbert and Will Flegel, and one member of the Independence Party, Clyde Miller. The current board, therefore, is tripartisan. The staff is always nonpartisan. We have nine FTEs, and in election years, we try to have a student worker come and assist us with some of our chores. We are a disclosure agency. We receive filings, make them available to the public in a variety of ways, in the office, hard copy, and on the web. We have a public use computer in our office for folks who don't have access to a computer. We make extensive use of our website to assist both clients and for disclosure. Our staff maintains and upgrades the website on a regular basis. The major program we have is campaign finance, as you all know. Registration for candidates, PACs, party units, and we pay public subsidy. In the year 2000, 99% of the registered candidates for the House agreed to limit their spending as a condition of getting public subsidy. In total, we have about 700 principal campaign committees registered with the board. We have 350 political committees and funds, and we have 350 party units registered. In the 2004 election, we paid a little over $1.7 million in direct payments to candidates. 267 candidates received money, and we paid $106,000 to the state party of the four major parties, EFL, Republican, Independence Party, and the Green Party. The funds come from the state voluntary checkoff and an additional $1.5 million appropriation into the general account of the state elections campaign fund each election year. In addition to the direct payments, we estimate that for the year 2004, an additional $4.5 million will be refunded to citizens through the PCR program. It's a voluntary program whereby individuals get $50 in contributions, and upon application to the Department of Revenue, those $50 contributions are refunded. A married couple can give $100. Public subsidy payments and PCR refunds are direct appropriations from the general fund of the state to support the candidacies of partisan candidates and are appropriated to the board for that purpose only. It's not part of the board's general fund. The PCR money is refunded directly to the individuals through the Department of Revenue. The only portion we have of that program is providing the receipt books to candidates and the parties. The board has developed a software program for candidates, PACs, and parties to use to assist them in filing their reports. In the 2004 election, about one-third of the candidates used the software, or filed electronically. More candidates are using the software, but for whatever reason, choose not to file it electronically. But we get a lot of paper reports in that have been generated from our software program. The software program assists with compliance in contribution limits, contributions from appropriate sources, excess contributions, warrants about excess spending, and contributions to the session. We provide online, we provide training sessions for software and one-on-one help when needed. We're revising our user manual to make it easier for folks to understand, and we encourage the use of the software. The board also administers the program that includes economic interest disclosure by legislators, constitutional officers, some legislative staff, and 1,100 other public officials. We provide filers with the current information to assist them in determining whether they need to amend. If amendments are needed, they need to be filed with our office by April 15th. All new House members this year will have to amend their previously filed information because they will have to add the state of Minnesota as a source of income. We also are the reporting and registration office for lobbyists. We have about 1,300 lobbyists. They report twice a year. We get 1,600 reports in twice a year from those lobbyists. Those lobbyists are registered to represent 1,300 principals, the associations for which they're lobbying. The principals report to us once a year on March 15th all of their expenditures in the previous year to the nearest $20,000. All reports are available for public viewing in the board's viewing room at the office. We have the list of principal expenditures on our web that comes out after April 5th or March 15th. And the website is also includes a list of lobbyists, list of principals, list of subjects on which those lobbyists are lobbying. The board also administers the ban on gifts from lobbyists to public officials and legislative staff. The board answers advisory opinions at the request of individuals or associations who wish to use the board's opinion to guide their own behavior. Advisory opinions do not set precedent, but they provide a safe harbor to the requester. If the requester abides by what the board has told them in an advisory opinion, they are protected from any other attacks on their conduct. The board has legislative recommendations for the 2005 session and is meeting with legislators about those recommendations. The governor's budget reduces the board's budget by $18,000. The greatest majority of the board's budget is spent on personnel and other fixed costs. The $18,000 we believe we can absorb. We're not sure we'll be able to hire the student worker in the 2006 election, however, because, again, most of our costs are personnel. We continue to add opportunities for electronic filing. In the last year, we provided electronic filing for for lobbyists. And this year will be the first year that principals will be able to file their reports electronically. That's voluntary program. They don't have to. They can still do paper copy. But, of course, it cuts down on our postage and paper and other stuff if they do file electronically. Historically, our costs are lower in a non-election year, and we are therefore able to carry funds into the election year when costs are increased for postage, personnel, data entry, and miscellaneous supplies. Another cost-saving measure we've undertaken is putting the names of clients who don't file their reports timely on our website. That's really encouraged folks to be timely in their filing, and it cuts down on certified letters, as the statute requires us to send certified letters. And certified mail has gotten really expensive, so we have found that publishing the names of non-filers on the website encourages compliance with the filing deadlines. The governor's budget also impacts the board's activities by eliminating the political contribution refund program. That would save us some money each year by not having to provide receipt books to the candidates and to the parties. The governor's budget also changes the public subsidy checkoff mechanism from a $5 direction by the taxpayer to the state to provide money into this state elections campaign fund. The new mechanism would allow the taxpayer to check off between $1 to $25, but it would be the taxpayer's liability then. It would not be state-funded any longer. It would be funded by the citizens. And the governor's budget also eliminates the $1.5 million direct appropriation to the general fund of the state elections campaign fund, which is a major source of support for candidates during an election. The board's current appropriation from the general fund is $712,000. In other efforts to decrease costs or increase efficiencies, we are currently in contract with the Department of Administration Management Analysis Division, looking at increased efficiencies in service delivery, communications, and enhancement of the board's website for greater use by clients and staff of the website. We have contacted a varied group of clients and got their ideas on what we can do to help clients, and based on that, board members and staff, we are implementing some of the issues even as we speak. We have searchable databases and lists on our website, which are constantly being upgraded. You can search contributions by the contributor, by the recipient, by the party of the recipient, and we are working to add searches by zip code, district, and other issues as time permits. We are working on the electronic filing of economic interest statements. Again, they have to be filed originally when somebody files for office or is appointed by the governor or the appointing authority, but then they do need to be updated, and we think that we can make it easier for folks to see what's there and to update them if we can get some electronic filing for you. We're also working on a method to allow clients to fill out their forms on the Internet. It wouldn't be electronic filing as such, but they could fill out the form on the Internet and then make a copy of it, download it, make a copy for themselves, and then mail in a copy to us. We're hoping to get web-based training available to all candidates in all programs, so it's easier for folks to find out what their responsibilities are. And one of the final things we're going to do on our new website design is provide a listserv whereby clients could sign up, provide their email address, sign up, and check boxes on programs they wanted to get periodic updates on, filing dates, when a board issues a new advisory opinion, and issues like that. Anyone can subscribe or unsubscribe at any time to get the information. And that's a brief overview of what the board's doing, what the budget's doing to the board, and Jeff and I are here and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Sackett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olson, ironically, on my way down, I pulled this cup out of the garbage on my way down to the committee hearing this morning, and I've been getting the emails back and forth from the association, and I think you're either you or your board, and trying to figure out why. You know, I understand that the cup may have some value and that it can't be given out. We've been told that it's cost $4.10 to produce and so forth. So my line of thinking was that if we paid $4.10 for the cup, we could keep it. Subsequently, we got a follow-up email that said, no, you have to pay, I think it's $14.95 or something for the cup, apparently because our picture is on it. And, I mean, I'm thinking unless you're a non-profit executive who wants the Seifert mug to use as target practice, why would my face on a mug be worth more than just the mug in general? You know, and why wouldn't we be able to buy it for the $4? Because I've had that question answered, like, oh, the campaign board's coming in. Why don't you ask that? So here we are.
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, I had informal conversations with legislative staff about, and this is the first I've seen the cup. It's interesting. especially with your picture on it.
Yes.
When I got the first question, I called PROAC to find out what it would cost me to get a coffee cup with a picture of my grandchildren on it. They told me it was $14.95 plus tax. I asked them what it would be if I brought in my own cups, and they said you can't. So with informal conversations with legislative staff, I told them that it appeared that the fair market value was $14.95. The board has not opined on this particular matter.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I remember a similar kind of ruling, which I know I ignored.
Representative Kahn, your microphone, please.
Okay. And that was the fact is that if someone gave you a commendatory plaque, that was supposed to be of value. I remember my solution was, which I didn't bother to do, and I don't know what happened. Was that allowed to stand or what happened? You know, there is this language of something of negligible value. And I think if you went to a garage sale in Marty Seifert's district and tried to buy that cup, you would discover that it was probably of negligible value. And my solution was going to be was that if there was some attempt to enforce that, I was going to take every plaque I had ever gotten in the 32 years, put them in a box, and deliver them to your office on the grounds that you then have to post them all. And I guess I'm not blaming you for what you did, and I'm not saying it, but how can we fix the law so that things that obviously have zero value, like, you know, maybe Representative Seifert's face has some value, but mine I'm sure has zero value, but and facts and things like that are not counted in this. How is this, you know, can we just even list them by name as they come up? Things of negligible value, such as mugs and cups and mugs and plaques and things like that. Is that a solution? What would have led you to a different, I know it's not an opinion, it's just whatever it is, but what would have led you to a different, what language should we have put in to lead you to a different conclusion?
Ms. Olson. Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, the legislature, you know, chose in its wisdom at the time to call it, to identify a trinket or memento of insignificant value.
Which I think that is.
They also have informational material of unexceptional value. They chose not to define what insignificant or unexceptional value is. If you want to put it, the legislature can do whatever it wants. If you want to put a dollar amount or if you wanted to say cups are okay. The board has struggled with the gift ban. As you know, we've issued many advisory opinions. And it's been uncomfortable for the board at times to have to get involved in people's social life. So I think if the legislature wants to do whatever it wants to do, but in the meantime, the board administers the words of the statute as they see it.
Thank you. Members, other questions?
Well, you know, Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, my suggestion is that we change that. What about plaques? What has happened about plaques? Has there been any? Was there any subsequent opinions? Has there any enforcement of that? You know, you could have a sweep through the building and just really make out like bandits with fines. You could do your whole budget with fines on people having plaques.
Madam Chair and Representative Hahn, there is no penalty for a violation of the gift ban. And as to plaques, it says plaques are similar memento recognizing individual services in a field of specialty or to a charitable cause. The board has said that voting is not a field of specialty, so your legislative service is not a field of specialty. The board has said that for, like, volunteer firefighters who get a plaque from the volunteer firefighters, that's certainly okay. But legislative service is not a charitable cause or a field of specialty. The board has said that maybe a framed, you go to Kinko's and you get the paper that's kind of outlined pretty and said, here's to Representative Khan for her something, and you put it in a frame, two frames of Target or Walgreens or something, perhaps that's okay. But again, these are words that the board does struggle with and trying to make sense of each of the words.
Representative Khan. Well, actually, those kind of have more value than the ones that are engraved or on marble, because at least with those you can take the piece of paper out and put pictures of your grandchildren in or something like that. But the others have significantly less value. So I'm not quite sure how this gets arrived. I'm not asking you to further delve into this. I'm just suggesting it to members that, I think we need to just add some extra words to that clearly say that plaques are allowed, mugs are allowed, and that sort of thing. Representative Silver.
Maybe what the words need to be added is to delete this section of law, period.
Representative Lane.
I'm curious how statute in Minnesota compares to some of our other neighboring states on this same issue, and what's done in other places like Wisconsin or other states in the country. How does our campaign finance laws here in Minnesota rank kind of against some of the other states in the country here?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know. I know Wisconsin does have a ban on gifts. I don't know how strong it is. I can probably get that information from the national organization, but I haven't done a comparison.
Ms. Olson, we have questions pending from Representative Mulry and Representative De La Forest. I just want to remind members that we are trying to get through all of these today, and we had allotted about 25 minutes for this division, or for this, so we're in a half hour. So, Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, you said none of the legislators are in the status of expertise or something like that, or profession. I think you were talking to Representative Khan, and I think many would argue with you on that issue. However, I have a serious question on insignificant to me from other areas of law. Certainly somebody $15 wouldn't even, nobody would even think of that as going beyond insignificant. And I'm wondering, have you looked in other areas of law where those have been, that word insignificant has been looked at? And because it seems to me you're applying it differently from what I've always heard, that from city prosecutors, different things. And I think maybe when they drafted the law, they may have been thinking of other areas of the law, the way it was interpreted.
Madam Chair and Representative Mulry, when the law was first passed, we did do a lot of that, and there doesn't seem to be good definitions out there, and the board felt at that time that the legislature meant something by that, and again, if there's a amount below which gifts are all right, that the board doesn't have an investment in this.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'll truncate my question. Ms. Olson, there's been no question here that we feel as legislators sort of puzzled by some of the rulings that are handed down by the Campaign Finance Board, and one of the recent ones that puzzled me was, I want to make sure I get the facts right, but basically there's an interpretation that you can buy pizza for your campaign volunteers, but you, the candidate, you can't use campaign funds. You have to sort of use your own cash to buy a slice of pizza, which I think is wholly unworkable, but I understand you work with the statutory framework we give you. And so I was wondering briefly if you could tell me, what is the thought process by the board when you interpret things? Do you sort of a strict constructionist policy, or do you adopt the canons of statutory and contract interpretation? What sort of framework do you use to interpret the laws we give you?
Ms. Olson.
We do not have an attorney on staff, as you know, and there's no requirement that there be one. So the staff generally drafts responses to advisory opinions and or complaints and has the attorney assigned to the board from the attorney general to do it, and then the board reviews it. On the food and beverage for fundraisers, I don't think the board ever went as far as saying that a legislator couldn't eat at their own fundraiser. That is not what the board said. The board said that you could provide food and beverage to campaign volunteers while they're engaged in campaign activities, but a legislator who goes out to lunch shouldn't consider that campaign activity and buy their own lunch. It was a very narrow ruling.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Senator Ryder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olson has been before various committees that I've sat on for the throughout the years, and I will tell you again, thank you very much. I happen to have a campaign treasurer as a CPA, so that's a true luxury in this business or profession, if you will, as a legislator. And is very pleased with the way that you have things online and so on, and we do file that way. I think it saves paper. Was there anything that we've done over the last year that would impact the way that you currently carry out your duties, or is there anything that concerns you that you feel may be a pitfall in the year 2006 when the entire legislature and the constitutional officers and the national races and so on come forward again? Is there anything that concerns you, benefits you, or any comments you want to make about that?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Ryder, I appreciate your comments, and I would just encourage all candidates to use the software, and if you can get your parties and party units or the caucuses to use it, it does save time. As you know, the state was rated very low on campaign finance and economic interest disclosure by a national group, and their major complaint was the fact that it was difficult to get the information timely. We try a day to enter the contributions as quickly as we can for like the pre-primary, the pre-general reports. There's no way we can get them in time before the election. So people have to come in to look at the file forms in our office, and that's difficult for out-state folks.
Could I follow up you? Senator Ryder, could we have this be the last question?
Yep. Absolutely. Was that mostly the individual legislators who were running, or was that more the larger groups, the lobbyists, the independent expenditures, any of that kind of thing?
I'm sorry, I don't.
When you say that there were problems of timeliness and so on, what entity was it that?
No, Madam Chair and Senator, I'm sorry, I confused you. The timing is us having the people to answer the reports. The reports are generally in on time.
Okay.
It's just that the list of contributors is so long, or the list of contributions that PACs and parties make is so long, that we can't get it onto our website in time for the citizens of the state to use it effectively.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll have the Office of Administrative Hearings, please. Oh, Ms. Olson, could I remind you that we need to, oh, you're doing it. We need to have you sign in, and all of the people who testify today, would you please remember to sign in for our record keeping? Judge Krause, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Raymond R. Krause. I am the Chief Administrative Law Judge and Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. I will make a brief overview of our office for many of you who are on the committee, and then go into our actual budget. The Office of Administrative Hearings is an independent central panel administrative hearing office for the executive branch. It was established by the legislature in 1976. Our office was the fifth central panel established in the United States. And now 26 states and the District of Columbia and the City of Chicago have all established central panel hearing offices. The mission of the Office of Administration, Office of Administrative Hearings is to provide an independent executive branch tribunal to conduct fair and efficient hearings and settlement conferences and to issue sound and timely decisions. The Office of Administrative Hearings has two operating divisions, the Administrative Law Division and the Workers' Compensation Division. The Administrative Law Division employs 9 administrative law judges and 4 staff attorneys. The Assistant Chief Judge and myself are included in that 9, and we both maintain active administrative law dockets as well as our administrative duties. The administrative law caseload has 4 components. First, by law, the OAH exercises oversight over the rulemaking by state agencies to ensure that they follow the law and the legislature's directives when adopting rules. The Administrative Law Division ALJs review all state agency rules before they are adopted, hold rule hearings when required, and make determinations about the legality of the rules, the need for them, and their reasonableness. Secondly, when state agencies take adverse regulatory or other actions against citizens or businesses, the State's Administrative Procedures Act requires, in many cases, that the affected parties have an opportunity for a due process hearing to appeal those actions. These are called contested case proceedings under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 14. The ALJs conduct these hearings for the various agencies. Also, from time to time, the legislature has directed OAH to conduct other kinds of administrative hearings that are not specifically governed by Chapter 14. Examples of these are municipal boundary disputes and annexation disputes, the Help America Vote Act complaints against the Secretary of State, and most recently, violations of the Fair Campaign Practice Act, which we just received jurisdiction for by legislation that passed last year. Finally, state law and or local ordinances often require that the state's political subdivisions conduct various kinds of due process hearings. The Administrative Law Division of OAH conducts these local government administrative hearings under contracts with a number of Minnesota cities and counties. For example, we conduct all the administrative hearings for the City of St. Paul. We conduct personnel and licensure hearings for the City of Minneapolis and most of the hearings for Hennepin County. Financially, the Administrative Law Division operates like a private law firm in the sense that we charge state and local agencies by the hour of the time that our ALJs and staff attorneys actually spend on their cases. The revenues that we collect from state and local agencies are deposited into a special revenue revolving fund that is appropriated to us by statute to pay Administrative Law Division's operational costs. The Workers' Compensation Division employs 24 compensation judges. It's organized into a hearing section and a settlement section. The latter was previously part of the Judicial Services Unit of the Department of Labor and Industry. In 1998, the legislature transferred the functions and the personnel of that unit to OAH. The Settlement Division provides alternative dispute resolution services that result in efficient final resolution of many disputes over the workers' compensation benefits issues. When the Settlement Division cannot resolve a dispute, it sends that case to the hearing section. When sent to the hearing section, a workers' compensation judge considers and decides motions, issues pretrial orders, and issues final decisions. The appropriations form an appropriation from the Workers' Compensation Special Fund funds the activities of the Workers' Compensation Division. Our current budget allows for 83.5 full-time equivalents in both divisions together, and the Administrative Law Division has a budget of $3.3 million, that's the monies that we collect and put into the special revolving fund. Then the workers' compensation division has a $14.5 million biennial budget funded by direct appropriation from the workers' compensation special fund. I should also add that the administrative law division also receives a $65,000 annual transfer from the general account of the state elections campaign fund to fund our activities with regard to the new legislation that we just got last year to deal with the campaign finance complaints that now come to our office. So the bottom line for our current budget is that we have no funds coming from the general fund. They are all either from the workers' compensation special fund, the appropriation from the state elections campaign fund, or from the revolving fund. We have, within the governor's recommendation, two change items. The first is the rate increase, which you'll find in your budget book on my page 3. I hope that's the same page for you. And what this is simply the rates that we charge the agencies to hold our hearings in the administrative law side of the office are set by the legislature. 2 years ago, the legislature cut the budget by 10%, as it did many other state agencies, and cut our rates by 10%. Unfortunately, the effect of that is that we then, every time we provide hearing service, we are providing a service at a cost that is greater than what we are able to charge, and our revolving fund has been decreasing accordingly. In other words, we're losing money the more work we do. And when we looked at that with finance this time around, they realized that that was not a long-term doable situation, and we've proposed that our rates go back to break even so that the rates that we charge equal the cost of doing service. In case any of you just anticipate a possible question, if we had fewer judges, yes, our costs would go down, but then we'd be able to take fewer cases and the revenue would be down. So just doing with fewer judges doesn't solve the problem in this case, because they are revenue generators. So the first change item merely brings the rate that we charge back to break even for the year, for the biennium. The second change item is for technology, and here we have not, all of our computer systems are at a minimum 6 years old. They are starting to crash and fail on a regular basis, and most of our customers, the state agencies that we hold hearings for and the Department of Labor and Industry for whom we do the workers' compensation hearings, are upgrading their systems, and our systems are no longer compatible with their systems. Our software and hardware are not keeping up with the other agencies, and so the request is for us to bring our systems up to the level that the other agencies are at so that we can continue to do electronic transfer of cases. For example, the Department of Labor and Industry has a very sophisticated imaging system where everything comes into the Department of Labor and is imaged and then disposed of. There's no paper, and everything is transferred to us electronically. And our cases are all on computer rather than having tons of files. Problem is that our systems are becoming less compatible as ours age and theirs get upgraded, and we run the risk of forcing Department of Labor to, after they've imaged all of these things, then print out all of these things and send them over to us in paper form, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we'd like to not undo the benefits that the other agencies have done by going, as you heard the previous speakers talk about, the advantages of going electronically. We'd like to just be able to not force them to undo that by having to then print everything out and send it to us because our systems are no longer compatible with theirs. The budget request would be for $226,000 in FY 2006 and $121,000 in 2007. Most of that is to just upgrade our systems and then provide ongoing maintenance of that system. Part of the reason we have this large gap in technology is because in previous years, although we've sort of fallen into the crack in that we're not small enough agency to take part in the small agency initiatives that were done through Intertech, but we were not large enough in the view of the budget committees to have our own budget, so we never had a budget for technology and kind of squeezed it out of other things. And the amount of squeezing has not been enough to keep us up to speed. And so that's why the request for technology.
Just Cross, to that technology, if we look at the funding detail on page 6, you're really adding, you're projecting that this will become an ongoing part of your budget. And the description that you make implies that we need to upgrade hardware and software to get compliance now.
Right.
But then you're making assumptions in the next two bienniums that you will need pretty much an equivalent investment in future years. So would you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, Madam Chair. What we are advised by the folks who know the technology better than I is that we have a substantial upgrade to do now, but to prevent us from falling back into this pattern of getting down to incompatibility and then spending a lot of money to get up to speed, we need to every year replace some of the equipment that's expiring and do it in an orderly fashion. The advice we get is that every 3 years you should be replacing all of your equipment, so a third, a third, a third, something to that effect. And that's what we're trying to plan for in doing this.
And Judge, are these costs then being built into your the fee set schedule so that you're maintaining a revenue stream for this technology investment based on your charges for service?
Exactly, yes, Madam Chair. These would be, for as far as the administrative procedure side of the shop, they would be built into the rates, and therefore we would be charging the agencies a fractional amount more to cover this. On the workers' compensation side, however, that would be, like the other expenses of workers' compensation, an increase in the appropriation from the special fund to cover that.
And then one final question, I'll turn to members. As with the governor's recommendation to go to raise you back up to a little bit higher than you were a couple years ago to 151, how much of these charges, my understanding is that part of the rationale was just to see if you could get more efficient, and also because a lot of these charges go back to state agencies that are funded by the general fund, so it has a general fund impact.
Correct.
So could you tell us what percentage of your hearings are conducted on, and you may have said it, and I just didn't pick it up, on behalf of state agencies?
I don't know. Bruce, would you...
Mr. Nelson.
Ask Bruce Johnson, the Assistant Chief Judge, on the percent that we do for non-state agencies, in other words, the counties and cities and that sort of thing.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Bruce Johnson. I'm Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge. That varies from year to year, and it, for some reason or other, is kind of cyclical. But right now, I would say that... I think it's in the range of 12 to 15% of our hearings are done for local units under contract, which means roughly 85 to 88% of our hearings are done for state agencies.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Rand?
Thank you. Either Mr. Krause or Mr. Johnson, if I remember correctly, when the governor made his recommendation 2 years ago to do this, it was part of the reduction was based on that it would help the folks that you were working with. Can you tell me, do you have any reason to expect, since it's going to be like a 12% increase, do you expect any local subdivisions, political subdivisions, to stop using your services?
Chair, Senator Renum, I don't believe that would be the case. Our trend has been increasing need for our services, not based on cost, but on an increase by local units of government finding that our hearings tend to stand up better in appeals to the Court of Appeals or District Court than if they do them themselves, and that seems to be driving the increase in our local business rather than just a cost factor. It's much less expensive, whatever the rate is, to have a final decision that stands up than to have it appealed to the Court of Appeals and retry it in the Court of Appeals.
Madam Chair, Senator Ranum, when we prepared our rate package for the Department of Finance, which we have to do every year, we actually did some research in terms of comparability, and the average billing rate for lawyers with experience that's comparable to our judges statewide is $267 an hour. So we're well below market. In other words, for a municipality to hire a private lawyer, it would cost them much more than to hire one of our administrative law judges.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, just one other question. I noticed on page 5 that as a part of your technology initiative, you're going to convert from the conventional telephone service to voice over IP service. Am I correct about that?
That's one of our proposals, yes.
As I learn a little bit more about that, and I certainly understand that that's a cost savings, I've also been aware that when we go to that, then you won't have 911 service if you eliminate all of your landlines. Has that been part of a discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator Ranum, no. We are not, other than an emergency that might happen in our office, we're not really part of the public safety system. I might add, at this point, we are leasing space from a private building owner in Minneapolis, which has security on site, and we sort of rely on that at this point. But the answer to your question is no.
Representative Silver.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Maybe this is a question for our fiscal staff, but on page 5, the majority of the expenditures for technology seem to be coming from the workers' compensation fund as opposed to a fee-for-service type fund that's only $23,000 of that is coming for fee-for-service. Maybe we can have a minute explanation of what the worker, who pays in the workers' compensation fund. I think that's employers surcharge on the workers' compensation premiums.
Madam Chair, I can have to answer that. The division for those things like technology that impact the whole office, the division between workers' compensation and administrative law sections of our budget is done by a formula, and you're right, most of it does go to workers' compensation because it is much, by far the larger division within our office, and we work out every year with the Department of Finance an analysis that says here how much should be allocated to what of the general expenses of the office, and that includes, for example, my salary, things like that. And so every year we relook at that depending on the spread between the administrative law side and the workers' compensation side and do an allocation of the general expenses based on that formula.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I understood that to begin with, but I want to point out to members that the technology isn't more just from the fee-for-service, an increase of $1 an hour on their charges, but much of it is coming from the workers' compensation fund, which is a fee paid by generally employers into the workers' compensation fund.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question, Judge, is an issue I talked to you about, I think the last budget, was the number of supervisors. Did you cut that one extra supervisor? Or?
We are in the process, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery. One of our supervisors is retiring, supervising judges on the administrative law side. We are in the process of putting together a streamlining package for the entire management of OAH, which I think will result in a more business-like approach to management and reduce some of the sort of top heaviness that we have at the moment. That hasn't been completed yet. We've been waiting on a couple of other things to get done first, but that is in the works and will be completed very shortly.
Congratulations on that. Second,
thank you.
Madam Chair, continuing. I've heard, and I don't practice in that field of law, but I've heard from some people that do something about a decrease in the ALJs over the last several years. Is that true or not, or what's the situation on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, yes, the number of ALJs has decreased over the last, 6 years?
Oh. Over the last eight, you want me to
the reason is we have found efficiencies to Senator Ranum's question earlier, and have been able to utilize staff attorneys to do more of the work at a lesser rate, so that we're actually charging a blended rate that is lower to the agencies for whom we do the hearings. We also have available contract attorneys, so that instead of building our ALJ staff to the maximum that we would ever need, what we have done is through attrition, winnowed that down to a number that we can keep busy pretty much all the time. And when we have sporadic increases in caseload, for example, the campaign practice stuff that came to us this fall, we had a big surge of cases in September and October. What we do is we take some cases and send them off to contract attorneys, who we only pay as we need them when they actually are doing cases. So we found it's much more cost effective than maintaining a large staff that isn't always busy.
Members, we need to move on for the others who are here. Representative Molly, could you make this a very short question?
I'll try to include it in one question. My concern is partly about that going to you have your ALJs have a very good reputation. The others are contracts aren't always exactly considered the best in the field. Did you request funding from the governor in his budget for additional ALJs or not, or?
For ALJs, no.
Yeah. What for anything else or for?
If you're referring to compensation judges for the Workers' Compensation Division, yes, not for the administrative law side.
Oh, okay. You did request them for.
We did put in our request to the Finance Department a request for two additional workers' compensation judges. Because we have been on the workers' compensation side, we have been reduced by six judges in the last biennium, and that was a reduction that was more than the reduction in the caseload, and so we were trying to get back up to.
How much would that? No,
Representative Mullery,
I
wonder if we could move on. Could we ask you to meet with the judge following the session? Thank you. Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Johnson and Representative Mullery. I apologize, but we have people who've traveled from long distances to be here and want to give them time as well. So could we please call the Indian Affairs Council? I'll just point out that Mr. Day drove in from Bemidji for our hearing, so we want to be sure to give him time. But we also want to hear from the other three councils this morning. Thank you. Mr. Day, we were hoping to give you 10 minutes, but we are running a little late, so if you could shorten your presentation, we'd appreciate it.
Bonjour. Gage Ball Station, a car dig. Robert J. Shield, do it dumb. The Saga Squatch of the Cubs, Nick Bahan. Good morning. My name is Joe Day. My Indian name is Walking Around. I'm from Leech Lake. My English name is Joe Day, Joseph Day. I'm the executive director of the Indian Affairs Council. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to present here today. And to really hasten this along, what I'd like to do is just give you a brief history of Indian Affairs and how Indian Affairs became part of the state legislature. It all began back in 1937, and you have a copy of that report in your packets. And back in 1937, Governor Ed Tye wanted to bring our communities together, the Indian and non-Indian communities, so he established a commission. You may recall through history, reading history, that during that period of time, we were coming out of the Great Depression, and also war was looming in Europe at that time. So the commission went about its business for 10 years and made the report to Governor Louis Biondo. And you'll find when you read the report that some of the same findings that occurred back in 1937, 1944 exist today about bringing our communities together. Also, the Interracial Commission is a precursor to the other councils that you're going to be hearing from today. 32 states across this country have Indian Affairs Commissions to advise the executive branch and the legislature. Minnesota Indian Affairs Council established in 1963 after a recommendation by Youngdahl to the governor's national conference, now the NGA, and that's how Indian Affairs Commissions were born. For the past 4 years, I've been a president of that organization. We'll be meeting in West Virginia this coming fall. To move on to Minnesota Statute 3.922 was established the Indian Affairs Commission, and within that framework, there was a mission statement developed, and that's within your packet. And that was just revised when I arrived at Indian Affairs 10 years ago, 10 plus years, and added to protect sovereignty of tribes as well as articulating that we're American Indian citizens of our own nations and also of the state of Minnesota as well as the United States. And the vision that we hold was to embrace our traditions and our cultural and spiritual beliefs since since 509 years ago. There have been means to, and public policy from the federal government to bring Indians into the mainstream of life, and we suffered spiritual, cultural genocide, and today you see some of those behaviors exhibited by our community with our young children joining gangs, high death rate, etc., that is a cause of historic trauma and cultural grief. So we need to really embrace those and look at some of those areas. The Indian Affairs Commission is composed of 11 tribal chairmen. Being elected on the reservation, you automatically sit on the Indian Affairs Commission. We have two at-large members, of which those members got to be a member of a federally recognized tribe not located in Minnesota. That is, you could be a member of the Blackfeet Nation in Browning, Montana, or Pine Ridge, live in Minnesota, and run for office to develop a platform for public policy for Indians from outside the state. We have eight commissioners that also sit on our board, and they're listed. I won't go through and bore you with it. We have ex officio members, liaison from the governor's office, three senators appointed by the Committee on Committees, and two of the majority party, and the House Speaker appoints three House members. And two of the members are from the majority party. FTEs, you looked at, we have in the packet, we have 5.5. When I first arrived, we had 7. But through the budget situation for the past 6 to 8 years, we've not filled positions so we could accommodate the office and keeping abreast with technology. And that's part of our real, I think, accomplishments that we can celebrate. You know, we're up to speed technologically. We have in our plan, you'll see in our also in the packet, it's called the Strategic Information Management Plan, and there's a business model preceding that that will show you the model that we use to put in and develop our business plan. And what we plan on doing is using website, interactive videos, and having several databases that if you want to know something about American Indians, you can access it. And we're in the process of developing that right now. You can go on to www.mniac.org and pull this out. You'll get our board members, you'll get our ex officio members, you'll get some treaty information, you'll get statistics about American Indians, you'll get our shrimp management plan on there, and you'll get, hopefully within the next few years, you'll have a number of opportunities to surf that site and ask any question that you may about us and find out information about us. The video conferencing, you can see on where the reservations are located, from the tip of Minnesota that juts into to the Great Lake Superior, to Granite Falls, to Red Wing, to Bemidji. When our board members have to travel, you know, for a two-hour meeting, you know, oftentimes they're spending a lot of windshield time. So hopefully by going to computer and video conferencing somewhere down the road using technology, that they can sit behind their computer and we can conduct a meeting. So that's in our dream. But the only thing that inhibits us today is access to high-speed line. You know, as you know, across Minnesota, not everybody has the luxury of DSL or using satellite, which is prohibitive for some of the tribes. You know, can't afford to link down with us. And to learn more about Indians, we'll have this on our website. The policies actually started in the 1400s by your ancestors, when the discovery began. You know, when Spain would send out their explorers, or England, they'd come across new land, they'd drive their flag into the sand and say, I declare this for the queen of, you know, whoever. And the international policy back then was the first person to arrive at these new lands had first option to negotiate with the indigenous folks. And that's what happened here in America. The Vikings supposedly got here first, and no one knew about it. The French came second. Then when the English arrived, they set up settlements and started negotiating with Indian people.
Mr. Dave?
Yes?
I don't mean to be rude, but would you help us concentrate on the function of your commission and the budget that you've requested, because we don't have very much time this morning.
The function of the Indian Affairs Commission is to inform the governor, the legislature, about initiatives and or problems that involve our community, whether it's a state law that's going to have an adverse impact on tribal people. We will advise you folks, and or if we have initiatives, we will utilize those elected officials that sit on our board to gain access to public policy in the state of Minnesota. The budget outline for full-time equivalents, we got $446,000 coming from the general fund. We get $60,000 from the feds, and that funds 5.5 FTEs. And utilizing these folks, we do work with the various committees that have budget oversight. We work with all the governor's cabinet and working these issues out, especially with like Commissioner Goodenough, who we have a very good working relationship with, and trying to meet the needs of Indian people. In the packet, there's also why we need to continue having this commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jay. Sorry to be curtail. We do have a couple of questions. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Day, thanks for coming down today from Bemidji. There are a lot of different governmental and non-governmental organizations dedicated to helping Native Americans. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, for example, the Department of Human Rights helps out. If you're a Native American, regardless of where you live in Minnesota, you have legislative representation. And as a decision maker here who will have to pass judgment on your budget here at some point, help me understand what it is about the mission of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council that isn't already done by one of these organizations or can't be done by one of these organizations or by Native Americans themselves, either in their individual or capacity as a tribe.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, Bureau of Indian Affairs does a lousy job. I think they listened to Custer when he went off to Little Bighorn. He said, don't do anything till I get back. That's one of the reasons. And Indian Health Service, there's not enough money to provide for health services for American Indians on a reservation. And the next question is, our board took the position that we're called American Indians, even though it's a misnomer. We're not Native Americans. You're a Native since you're born here. I think the lack of understanding about who we are is an excellent opportunity to educate the world, including the legislature. And there are 55,000 Indians in Minnesota, 60% live off reservation, therefore don't have that direct tie with the federal government and the federal relationship that tribes enjoy. And funding from the federal government does not meet the needs of Indian people. You know, you take a look at the poverty level of Indians and unemployment, high death rate, and so forth. In the words of John F. Kennedy, Indians are probably the least understood and the most misunderstood in our nation. So, and that's the reason that we are here.
Mr. Day, Representative De La Forest, I've spent a lot of time on the Health and Human Services side of our enterprise here in the legislature, and I would just point out to you that the health department has a health disparities initiative that looks at different populations, differing health needs. The Department of Human Services, which Mr. Day referenced, has a, I think starting in about 98, has a staff assigned to work with the tribes, and the report that you're getting here from NCSL about the rights of tribes to offer and conduct many of the health and human services and other tribal courts and so on as sovereign nations. We consistently have this liaison function, which I think the Indian Council is intended to provide. You might look at at their report of the strategic initiative.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, and I think we all have a concern when we look at some of the staggering rates of poverty and alcoholism and other things on reservations and other places, and that's why I ask these questions. There is an education process that's very necessary, and I look at page 7 of the business plan that was provided for us, and the number one listed service given an A priority is to counsel the legislature on these issues. And I think here in my second term, I've never had anyone from the Indian Affairs Council come and visit my office, and certainly the invitation is open. I would like to learn more about that, and that sort of is the nature of my question, is let you know I'm listening and I want to learn more.
And I think that's an invitation, Mr. Day. We need to move on. I would have several people who have asked to speak. Representative Blaine,
I have one.
Representative Kahn, and then Senator Ryder.
Thank you very much.
Representative Blaine.
Oh, Mr. Day.
Mr. Day, excuse me. We have questions for you.
Okay.
I wanted to move on in terms of getting the members' questions answered.
And,
but I'm reminding the members that we do have three other groups that were planning to speak with us today.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Day. Thank you for your service on the Indian Affairs Council. On page 8 of your strategic management plan, there's 7 bullet points there on data dealing with the poverty level and some other very troubling statistics. On the Indian population in the country, and I'm wondering, you had mentioned your website that you're putting together here in the state, and is there data that would be that would be simply statewide here in Minnesota that would address those same seven bullet points that we could access.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, our website is under construction, so we're currently putting those on to refine what's in Minnesota, and we will have that available hopefully soon. And I'd just like to pitch that there were 67 new House people elected 2 years ago, and try to get to 67, it's for one person to get around is a challenge. So hopefully I will come to see everyone. Thanks.
One more question, Madam Chair, if I may. Mr. Day, you represent all of the tribes of the state of Minnesota, and there's been talk lately about the governor's proposal on gaming, and I'm curious if you, as the head of the Indian Affairs Council, have taken a position one way or the other on the governor's proposal on gaming as it affects the Native American tribes here in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Representative, by motion at one of our meetings, I don't answer those questions on gaming. We just deal with other things other than gaming. So if it were anything, it would be personal and simply that.
So the council has not taken a position?
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, this may be a question to you, but or both. The issue of looking at the NCSL publication, has Minnesota ever established tribal TANF programs?
Yes, Representative Kahn, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, each tribe has the option, Mr. Day can correct me, each tribe has the option of operating its own TANF programs, and some tribes have elected to do that. Is that correct, Mr. Day?
That is correct. In 1995, when the Welfare Reform Act kicked in, as a matter of fact, a year later, we had Senate File 1 addressing that issue. The Mille Lacs Reservation opted immediately to assume their own TANF. Others are learning, as you know, it's a very complex issue. So some tribes have taken portions of it. However, they are working towards that end.
Also in the area of child protection, Representative Kahn. And in the area of tribal courts and law enforcement. So there's a variety of functions by the tribal initiative, and I'm sure it's related in part to size of tribe and resources. So.
Correct.
Senator Ryder.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I had the pleasure between 1992 and the end of 95 to be a member of the Minnesota Board on Aging, and that particular board does all the administration for the Older Americans Act funds, which is not an insignificant amount of money. And we went to very great lengths to make certain that, first of all, those funds flowed directly to the tribal areas wherever our Native American Indian elders lived, and to make sure that we delivered programs to them. And you're talking geographically, not a small problem, but that board is to be thanked for everything that they have done for our elders, and I've kind of watch that through the years to make sure that they're still getting a almost a better than average fair shake, if you will. I think they do very magnificent work, and just want to say that I hope that's still ongoing. If it isn't, I'd like to know about it, but I believe they do a yeoman's job.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Senator Senjum, could we please move on?
I just have a yes or no.
All right, Senator Senjum. Yes.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, you may ask your questions, Senator Senjum.
And you may choose not to answer it, Mr. Day, but does the Indian gaming industry or consortium at all support your budget?
Madam Chair, no.
So we have a yes and a no. Thank you very much, Mr. Day, and let's try what members we are running a little bit behind, and I have lost my agenda here. Next, we have the Council of Black Minnesotans. Welcome, Mr. Collins. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Lester Collins, and I am the Director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans, and have been with the Council for I think about 16 years now. We were created or brought to life in 1980 and have been in existence since that time. There's a lot of written material before you. We have the 2060-20 report, which pretty much delineates how the functions of the council are broken down in terms of the budget that we receive. They are truly within the areas of black families and children's issues, criminal justice issues, education issues, and health issues. Our functions are very similar to the Indian Affairs Council and the other councils that will come before you. It is basically to advise this body, but is also to advise and to inform our community and to represent, if you will, to be a voice as it relates to their concerns. Madam Chair, I would like to not take for granted this morning the fact that we do have members from our community that are present here, and among them are the NAACP, the African American Leadership Council, Black Church Coalition, and the Ministerial Alliance, and others that are here this morning. And I personally want to thank them for taking the time to be here. At the same time, I want to say to you that it really is no surprise to me that they are, because we work very hard with a very limited staff of basically four full-time staff. And I do want to recognize Roger Banks, who is the research analyst with the council, who is here with me this morning, which means that two of the four individuals that we have are presently, you know, here, if you will, on the Hill. The other two administrative folk are, you know, of course, in the office. I will make mention that we do have a tobacco network individual that is essentially funded by NPAT in our office. That position will end, I believe, on December 31st of this year as it relates to tobacco-related concerns, mostly cessation and education within our community. I guess what I, among the many things I would like to say to you is that, number one, we are, I guess if it would be appropriate to say, grateful that the governor's recommendation is basically to maintain the council's funding at its present level or its former level. And I think in challenging budget times, I should be pretty thankful that that is the case. And let me be clear that I am. But it also troubles me that that our budgets, and I'm going to speak as it relates to all the councils at this particular point, have remained, you know, pretty lean. And what troubles me most is that they remain lean and have in what I would call the so-called good times or better times. And we essentially take the same kinds of impact or cut, you know, to the same kinds of levels other agencies are in what would be lean times. So it just seems to me that we struggle and have struggled, particularly as a council, in my opinion, in good and bad times. So again, I want to reiterate the fact that I'm thankful that our budget basically remains, or at least the recommendation at this particular point, because it is before you as a body of the same. There's one thing I do want to point out. I think among the information that you have, and I'm not seeing it in the packet, you know, of information that I have, which would be very similar to yours, is some information dealing with the Governor's Commission on the Martin Luther King celebration. Our office has coordinated that event for at least the last 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, and we were asked to do that, you know, by certainly a previous administration. My concern is that as you look at the council's budget, there used to be a time when it was delineated or clearer that there were dollars from the King administration that were essentially a part of our, if you will, fiscal management or responsibility. Over the years, it's kind of emerged to where the council's budget looks comparable, if you will, to at least some of the other councils. But the fact is that among that is the King celebration, which as far as I'm concerned, operationally or otherwise, if anything, is taxing to the organization from the standpoint of staff time and involvement. And additionally, we raise funds about, on average, about $40,000 to do the King celebration. And by the way, I'd like to, give you a standing invitation to attend what would be, I guess, the 2006 event at this particular point. There are generally about 2,000 to 3,000 people, that attend that event. One of the points that I want to make here is that so often the King celebration, if you will, number one, is viewed as a one-day event, which concerns me. And the other thing is that somehow it would appear that it is a black, holiday, or it seems to me that given King's emphasis, vision, dream, concern, and I would say for having made a better American, for that effect, a better Minnesota, it seems that the council, in my opinion, is taxed, if you will, by virtue of the fact that we administer the holiday. And my point is, it very much looks like our budget is at least larger than it is. And I want to you to understand, given the cost and the administration of that holiday, which we think that we do on behalf of the state, it seems to me that we take a hit by virtue of that. So my concern is, I would like to see that budget, separated out as it started, in the beginning. And it would mean that the dollars that you're looking at are actually much less, by about $16,000 to $25,000 in terms of the council budget, than what you're actually looking at. So I just wanted to make that point.
Collins, thank you. I will note that our budget book says $18,000 of your allocation is for that purpose. We are at the time that the committee is supposed to be adjourning, and there's another committee coming in. Apologies to the Chicano Latino Affairs Council and Asian Pacific Council for not managing the time a little bit better this morning. We'll have you back another day. But if I could have Mr. Collins wrap up your presentation so we can conclude today's hearing and let the next committee come in.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would like to say that we are, as a council, have been and still are challenged technologically. We have just established a website, which we're very proud of, in terms of the kind of outreach education, not only to you, but to the community. We are still challenged. We have a statewide responsibility. And frankly, again, I'm glad that we, or the governor's recommendation for the dollars received, are as they are. But I can tell you, given the increase in population, both African and African-American in the state, that it would make for a better Minnesota if we were equipped to aid you in serving what I would consider our citizenry in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being
Representative
Silver.
Question on the bullet and the budget request or history. You have from special revenue at $90,000. Is that the tobacco?
It
appears in 2006 and it disappears in 2007.
I would almost be yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Members, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.